Welcome to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast, a weekly conversation about mental health, personal development, and all the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. For more information or to find a therapist in your area, visit our website at therapyforblackgirls.com. While I hope you love listening to and learning from the podcast, it is not meant to be a substitute for a relationship with a licensed mental health professional. Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for joining me for session 355 of the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. We'll get right into our conversation after a word from our sponsors.
Hi, my name is Elua Arthur, and I'm on the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. I'm in session today unpacking my work as a death doula.
Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a national Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. I've seen quite a few videos on social media recently of young women soliciting help in finding the perfect dress for graduation. Might I suggest you add Macy's to your list? They have lots of options for dresses that will transition perfectly from under your gown to that incredible dinner with family after the ceremony. Check out options from brands like On 34th, Michael Kors, DKNY, and many more. Shop at Macy's.com or in store. Hey ladies, it's Dr. Joy. As women, we put our hearts into everything. May is High Blood Pressure Education Month, and it's time to focus on our heart health. Release the Pressure wants to help Black women look at self-care as an act of self-preservation. During High Blood Pressure Education Month, let's help get to our goal of 100,000 Black women putting their hearts first and learn more about their heart health. Visit iHeartRadio.com/RTP for a chance to receive a $1,000 gift card to take care of yourself and prioritize your heart health. That's iHeartRadio.com/RTP. It is guaranteed that everyone on this earth will eventually die. And yet, the process is made difficult with considerations such as appointing an authorized representative, leaving dependents behind, and other bureaucratic formalities that can be outright cruel to deal with when you're already experiencing grief. Stepping in to help with these considerations are death doulas, who work to make this monumental transition as smooth as possible for both the dying and their families. To talk with us today about what it means to be a death doula, I'm joined by death doula and newly published author of the memoir, Briefly Perfect Human, Elua Arthur. Elua is the founder of Going With Grace, a death doula training and end-of-life planning organization that exists to support people as they answer the question, what must I do to be at peace with myself so that I may live presently and die gracefully? In our conversation today, we discuss the training and certifications required to become a death doula, how death doulas assist both the dying and their families in making end-of-life decisions, and how dying means becoming comfortable with the idea of leaning on our community for support. If something resonates with you while enjoying our conversation, please share it with us on social media using the hashtag TBGInSession. Or join us in the Sister Circle to talk more about the episode. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. Here's our conversation. Hey, Lua, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's an honor to chat with you. So I wonder if you could get started by telling us a little bit about what inspired you to go into doing the work of being a death doula.
Sure. About 10 years ago, I was practicing law at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles, and I grew really, really depressed, clinical depression. And I took a medical leave of absence from work. And during that leave of absence, I went to Cuba, where I met a fellow traveler on a bus who had uterine cancer. We spent a lot of time talking about her life. Then I started asking her about her death, and she answered. And it was one of the first times that she'd felt safe enough, comfortable enough to discuss the potential for her dying from her disease. And it made me really sad that this stranger had nobody that she could talk to death about. But also, for the first time, I started looking at my own life through the lens of my death. We both had terminal illnesses, if left untreated, depression certainly being one of them, in my estimation anyway. And so I considered, if my disease had killed me, what would I have made of my life? And I wasn't happy with what I saw. And so I decided to make some changes in my life, which included studying death. But about 6 months after I came back from Cuba, my brother-in-law, Peter St. John, became ill, and I got to support him through the end of his life. And that's when I saw firsthand the grim reality of people walking through the medical care system, engaging with death and dying. And I didn't like what I saw there either. So I decided to do something about that too, and built a death doula practice.
Wow. So tell me more about when you said you started learning more about death. Were you enrolled in formal courses? Were you reading books? What was that practice like?
I read everything I could get my hands on. I talked to everybody about death. I mean, I'm talking about the cashier at CVS and Rite Aid, okay? I'd be like, have you ever thought about dying? Kind of like the Barbie movie. I just was so full of the conversation. I also found a death midwifery program here in Los Angeles through an organization called Sacred Crossings, where I learned how to care for bodies after death and natural death care principles and practices like green burials, etc. But the practice that I have right now, the one that I built, is one that I learned from studying a bunch of different practice areas. Like, I went to my estate planning friends and asked them to sit with them as they walk people through wills and trusts and estates. I got a job at an alternative funeral home. I volunteered at hospices, got a job at a hospice. I did as much as I could to learn what it looked like to properly support people through dying to build the practice that I have right now.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm curious to know how you have been able to take care of your own mental health doing this kind of work, and if you saw any change in your depressive symptoms after switching to doing this kind of work.
I felt a massive change in my depressive symptoms. Don't get me wrong. I think depression is something that I'll probably dance with my entire life. Maybe it's in my chemistry and my DNA. Maybe it's just in the way that I experience the world. But I did feel a shift. Majorly, because at the time I wasn't capable of much of anything. I couldn't make meals. Showering, I only did because I didn't want to stink. But other than that, I wasn't really capable of doing much. And what I found through my work was that, well, mostly through being with death and dying, is first of all, the impermanence in any emotional mental state that I'm experiencing, which allows me to just be with it for what it is and not think it's never going to end, which is certainly something that I felt in the depths of my depression. But next, also, I have a little bit more clarity of purpose of being. And I don't mean in my work necessarily, while I thoroughly enjoy my work, I've gotten a chance to sit with why I'm here and what I enjoy about being here, which allows me to reframe often when the symptoms come back or when things start getting to feel like I can't carry them anymore.
So talk to me about your work. What does a day look like as a death doula?
Sure. For starters, let me just define. So death doulas do all of the non-medical care and support of the dying person and the circle of support through the process. And when I say dying person, I mean anybody who has some awareness that one day death will come, which means healthy people too, that have started to live with awareness of their mortality. We help healthy people complete comprehensive end-of-life plans and people that know what it is that they're going to be dying of because they have an illness. We help them create the most ideal death for themselves under the circumstances. And after a death occurs, we help family members wrap up affairs of their loved one's life. A day in a life typically looks like waking up and checking to see who's still living. First of all, a lot of gratitude that I woke up that morning. And next, also checking in to see what happened with my clients overnight, probably go to a few end-of-life planning consultations, do some home visits and check in with the clients to see how folks are doing. And then a lot of emails and paperwork. One thing that I didn't really account for was that building a practice meant that I was going to be an entrepreneur, which meant that I had to build a business and run a business. And that is not for the faint of heart, okay? So that was one of the most surprising difficulties in getting this whole thing up and running.
Can you tell me more about like an end-of-life consultation? What does that look like?
Yeah, that looks like helping somebody fill out their end-of-life plans and paperwork. Often, I'm working with healthy people when doing this. So we walk through an advanced planning tool that covers about 9 basic areas to make sure that folks have a lot of their plans down. I think most important is that people complete advanced directives, starting with your medical decision maker. Who's going to make your decisions for you in the event that you can, the event that you become incapacitated? That person is also called a medical power of attorney. Also important is life support decision making. What do you want done in the event that your life cannot be saved, but perhaps it can be prolonged for a bit longer, staving off natural death from occurring? Also, getting clear on your care and comfort, how you want to be cared for near the end of your life, what you want done with your body after death, your services, considering your possessions, if you're going to have a will or a trust or an estate, what you want done also with your sentimental items, thinking about your dependents and pet care, so dependents being children or disabled adults that are under your care, also considering all your biographical information and details, and then also all your accounts, your online accounts, like getting your passwords and any accounts that hold financial information, making sure all those are in there. But the last thing, which I find most important, is thinking through your values around living, because one beautiful thing that death does for us is put a highlight on our lives. And so if we can think about the values that we have in our living and start getting clear on those, writing them down, that can be a really, really powerful tool in end-of-life planning.
And is this something that's typically done in conjunction with other family members? Is there software involved in like housing all the passwords? I'm thinking through the logistics of all of this.
Great questions. I love having families involved. Once, about maybe 3 years or so ago, I got to support 3 generations in end-of-life planning. So they all came together around a dinner table in the living room. There was probably about 16 people there, and everybody filled out these documents. It's analog, because I'm still a very analog girl. But it's a document that I created where we talk through all the items in there, and then they get to keep it. For the account cataloging, often I suggest that people write down the accounts that hold financial information, such as like Amazon and eBay and places where your credit card information might be saved, including your banking information, etc., so that those can be easily accessed. And then I also encourage folks to sign up for some password storage systems.
And how are people typically like finding you to work with you? What does your caseload, I guess, kind of look like?
Well, it looks like a lot of different things. Lately, I'm not seeing clients as much because I've gotten really, really busy with my book that's coming out and teaching death doulas. But people find me a variety of ways. I think from all of the word of mouth, because I've been able to be with quite a few people in their considerations around dying. And also through students, which is really great because folks come to learn how to become a death doula and then they start furthering the work out there. But I think that as the work starts to penetrate more of mainstream society, people get curious about it and start going snooping, trying to find one. And I'm really happy that they do.
Yeah. I mean, and as you're talking, you know, a lot of your work sounds like what we might think happens in hospice. But I wonder, could you tell me, like, what is the difference between the work that you do and traditional hospice and how might those two fields collaborate?
I'm so glad you asked. They're really collaborative, if you ask me. We can just be an extra set of hands, eyes, ears, human for the dying person and the family. Hospice often has, they hold all the medical stuff. So the doctor, the nurses, the CNAs, LVNs, certified nursing assistants, licensed vocational nurse, etc., folks that come in to handle the physical needs of the dying person. Granted, there also is a chaplain and a social worker that might be part of the hospice team, but we get to be a really holistic care. So I'm looking at all of the client's needs in totality and making sure that everything is covered. So there are things that the hospice team won't do or can't do necessarily that the doula can do. Also, I can be available when I choose to be 24 hours a day, whereas you can't expect the doctor to pop in whenever you might want.
Got it. And I feel like sometimes hospice care is paid for by insurance, correct?
Yes. A lot of times it should be covered by Medicare. Yeah.
Is your work covered by insurance at all?
It's still private pay for now, largely because of licensing requirements, et cetera, that we haven't totally found a way through yet.
Got it. Okay. You said that sometimes like the family is involved with the planning. How much of your work involves talking with the family about the end of their loved one's life?
A lot. My job is to support people who have some awareness that death is coming. And that's not always the case for somebody who's nearing the end of life. Some people resist it all the way to the end, which means that I can be hired by the family members to support them as they support the person who's dying. There's been many a times when I've worked with a caregiver who says, hey, this looks like a mess and it looks like death is coming, and what do I need to do in order to prepare? What information do I need, et cetera? Also, the folks that are around the dying person are also in a massive experience themselves and also require some support. They are maybe dealing with anticipatory grief or frustration or anger or whatever it may be, and they need support too. So we focus on the dying person and the circle of support through the process.
So I'm curious about all of the reading and the learning that you were doing as you were preparing to start your organization, Going with Grace. What kinds of things did you learn that you feel like have really become foundational to the work you do with your organization?
For starters, I really sunk into the impermanence of everything, as I was just mentioning, is in order to be with dying, we have to shift first, I think, into the psychosocial, spiritual elements of it to allow us to get into the practical things as well, because the practical don't make any sense unless we're also dealing with the other stuff. And so when I started to like zoom out and think about death and dying holistically is when it allowed me to properly sit down and say, okay, what are the things that actually need to happen? Now, there are different entry points for the work, and some clients aren't interested in talking about the emotional, relational, psychosocial, spiritual elements of dying, but really just want to get their stuff done. But the two always come together one way or another. So that was something that really supported is thinking about dying theoretically and creating a framework for that. And then from there, as I had to learn about how deep bureaucracy is after death occurs, that really started shifting the game for me. It's a whole beast after somebody dies trying to get all their affairs wrapped up. And I was not prepared for that at all.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that surprised you with that process?
Oh my gosh. After my brother-in-law died, I was trying to help my sister before I left to go take care of myself because I'd been with them for a couple of months at that point. And it was not quick. It wasn't brief at all. I was trying to transfer title of his car to his nephew because we thought we'd just give the car away after he dies. Turns out that's not the case at all. It is a long drawn out process where the car had to enter into the estate formally. And then through the probate process, then we had to determine who the executor was going to be. And then the executor had to go to the DMV and on and on and on and on and on in order to do this. That was just one thing, but also things like trying to figure out what pension he'd held through his job or trying to get access to his cell phone because we didn't have access to the passcode. I'd call or try to reach out to some system and they'd want to talk to him to get verification. I'd be like, he's dead. Like, it's part of the reason I called is because he died. It was like an unending wellspring of bureaucracy and a lot of blocks and obstacles in that bureaucracy as well. It was very foolish of me to think that the bureaucratic rules would favor the grieving, but they don't at all. In fact, you need to have all your wits about you and be extra resourced in order to process something like that. But while doing it in the midst of deep grief is cruel to me. I can't understand for the life of me why the systems are set up this way that make it that much harder for people that are suffering to navigate.
Right. And ideally, it sounds like somebody would work with you before the end of their life so that this stuff is kind of all taken care of. But does your work also sometimes start working with the family after a loved one has passed to help with some of this? And then how do you get permission, I guess, to kind of speak on behalf of the family? Like, is there some kind of paperwork that companies need to know that you actually are authorized to speak on their family's behalf?
Yes, that is an authorized representative form. That's the form that I use. And I'll have them fill out several of them and just change it, the name of the company that I'm trying to access. And sometimes it's really difficult. But yes, I often work with folks after the death has occurred. In a few of them, there's been both mom and dad have died at the same time, and they've left adult children with multiple houses and lines of credit and kids from one marriage, kids from another marriage, trying to figure out who inherits who. In the couple of cases that I've done that one of them went on for about a year and a half, where we're trying to piece together all the accounts that were open and all the possessions that they had, etc. But I went to law school, so my brain has been highly trained to take in a big amount of information and whittle it down to its finest points. And that cost me only $113,000 and 3 years of my life. That aside, that being able to access information that way and use it that way is really supportive in a situation like that, because I can look big picture at all the things that need to get done and all the things that we need and shave it down and make it much easier for the family members to digest afterward.
Right. More from our conversation after the break. But first, a quick snippet of what's coming next week on TBG.
I believe a lot of the misconceptions that I dislike that I wish we could just completely eliminate are the ones that revolve around how people perceive you based off which organization you're in. So if you say you're a Sigma woman, a Delta woman, a Zeta woman, or an Alpha woman, people instantly have this idea of how you think, how you move, how you cook, even how you navigate life in your relationships. But the reality of it is you cannot generalize us based off our organizations. If anything, that should inspire you to get to know us about our values and our morals better.
Growing up watching media legends like Gwen Ifill and Robin Roberts always gave me the security that stories that matter to me would be told. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a National Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and Brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and Macy's is highlighting some really cool AAPI-owned brands right now, online and in-store. Some of my favorites are the jewelry from Hey Maeve and the skincare products from Kaja. For the entire month of May, join Macy's in supporting AAPI-owned fashion brands. You can show your support by donating online or by rounding up in store to benefit APIA scholars. APIA is the nation's leading nonprofit organization devoted to the academic, personal, and professional success of Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander students. Join me by rounding up your purchase to the nearest dollar at checkout to support API Scholars, an educational nonprofit. Shop Asian American and Pacific Islander owned brands at Macy's.com or in store. So you mentioned that a lot of your work now is training other death doulas. Can you talk about what that training process looks like? What is required to become a death doula?
Ooh, that's my favorite part. Well, for starters, I think it's really important for folks to have a bit of comfort in emotional depth, to not run from like big emotions, because there's a lot of them when death and dying come around. That doesn't mean that you can't have any. In fact, I think my sensitivity and my capacity to access my emotions is really a strength for me in this work. But the training course that we have at Going With Grace is a 14-week, 14-module program, either done online or in retreat in person. And I think any death doula training program worth its weight should have the individual look at the work through the lens of self. It's wildly important that each individual have a personal relationship with death so that we can avoid collapsing the space between ourselves and the other. If I'm clear about what my relationship with death looks like, then I won't put all my fears on you and vice versa. I won't take yours on. But we look at our conscious dying. We bring our attention to our own death. We consider the hospitals and the role of medicine in our work, even though we do non-medical care. We also look at signs of dying, understand what's happening with the body. We do some natural death care, learn how to wash and prepare bodies after death that we support family members in. We support folks in home funerals and learning about the funeral industry, legacy ritual and meaning making, so helping folks create rituals for themselves, advanced planning and advanced directives, wrapping up affairs after a loved one dies, grief, bereavement, burnout, and then lastly, self-care and business and practice building. So the course is set up to move through all the modalities and end-of-life care in hopes that the person who's shown up for the work can find an area that feels really good to them to carry out there.
Got it. A lot of this sounds similar to what the training to become a therapist is in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, like, how do you teach and how did you learn in your own training to kind of manage your own emotions around either your death or the sadness of working with somebody else who's dying? Like, how are you managing your emotions related to these kinds of things happening?
So many of us that come to the work of death, and I can imagine same for therapists, are highly empathic people. Most of us came because somebody died in a way that broke our hearts or experienced something so beautiful and idyllic. We want everybody to have it. And that means that so many of us are willing to like take so much on for other people. And so I've had to work really hard on shoring up my boundaries and getting clear on what belongs to me, what is mine to carry and what is not. Because otherwise I'd just be walking around like with the weight of the world of death and grief on my shoulders. So recognizing what is mine as opposed to what belongs to somebody else is really, really helpful. Can I just tell you a quick story about a client?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Years ago, I went to go see a client and her sister. I have three biological sisters. They were young Black women, and one sister was dying. And I was with them through the time that they were there in the hospital. When the doctor came in, I would listen, ask questions, support them and making sure that they had the information they needed. And when the doctors were gone, we sat together for a while. At some point, the sister who wasn't yet dying started crying. And I was overcome with emotion for her. Her sister, who was in the bed, also started crying. I started weeping with them. And when I tell you, just all of my sister's sadness, fears of loss came up in that space. I was certainly in my own emotional experience. I was with them, but also in my own experience. I was collapsing the space between the two of us. I excused myself, got it together, and came back into the space, and then eventually went home. And I beat myself up for like a few hours thinking, gosh, they called me to come in there and hold the container, and I collapsed directly into it. And I felt awful about that. Just terrible. A few days later, sister calls and she thanked me. She said it was the first time everybody else who was coming into the space had been so professional, or they said things like, sorry for your loss, or They spoke in very technical terms, and it was the first time that a professional, and I'm using air quotes, expressed some humanity, and she was very grateful for that. And since then, I've given myself a lot of grace for crying, because I cry everything. I cry joy, I cry beauty, I cry frustration and anger and sadness and all the rest too. So I think as long as I can be aware of what belongs to me and what belongs to somebody else and hold my boundaries tight, then it works out okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, you know, and again, similar to our training, like we understand that sometimes there are certain cases you can't take on because you over-identify, right, with the client. And so then it is harder to hold that boundary. I'm wondering what it looks like for you as a trainer to maybe sometimes have to have difficult conversations with trainees about maybe you need to take a step back from the work, or like what kind of work they need to personally do to be able to hold space for a family or a person.
For starters, we ask folks that have experienced a death within the last 6 months to circle back later, because sometimes folks are coming as an expression of their own grief and they want to, you know, heal it through this experience. And maybe, but also maybe just take a breath, take a minute, take a nap, and then come back and let's consider it. But next, we do a lot of work around the shadow self and the space from which we are giving. Those are some tough conversations sometimes, because we have people that want to come in and help everybody and fix everything. And there's no fixing death and grief and loss. And also, what part of you feels like you are the one who can fix somebody else's something? What is this like savior or healer thing that you're working with that says that it is mine to do on behalf of somebody? So making sure that folks are checking that as often as possible. In there is a really dense conversation about privilege, I think, and bias. And so much of our training also focuses on looking at the privilege that we carry to be in this position, to be able to support other people, and also the privilege that we carry just by virtue of our background and our past and our history and our intersections of identity, because those often impact, I think, how we want to show up to support the other person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. So you mentioned that a part of why insurance does not cover this, at least as yet, is that like there are concerns around like licensing and like figuring all of that out. Are there particular certifications that a death doula has, or like how would we vet if we are looking for somebody to provide this kind of care? How would we find like trustworthy individuals?
Well, there's no official certification body, no certifying body for death doulas. However, we're organized by the National End of Life Doula Alliance, and they have a proficiency assessment that any death doula can take. And when you pass that test, you get a little badge that you can put on your website or to whoever asks to show that you have the basic core competencies of the work. But I suggest that when folks are looking for some place to seek training, that you find somebody that you resonate with, like somebody that feels good in your spirit, and somebody who's doing the work the way that you would like to do it, because that's likely what you're going to learn, and then up to you to decide how you carry it on out there. But for folks that are looking for a doula, I suggest, first of all, that you check out the National End of Life Doula Alliance to see if that person has a proficiency badge. You also look at the organization where they got their training and who are behind that organization, because since we're not licensed or credentialed in any way, there are a lot of different training programs popping up, and you can get a doula certification in 2 hours, or you can spend 3 months deep in the consideration. And so consider the organization the person's coming from, or their background and history, because they may not have gone to get any formal training, but may have been the one that went with their grandma for years when they were growing up into the community to support the people that were dying. So there's a number of different ways to access training.
Got it. So you've already offered a little bit of this, but what other suggestions would you have for somebody who's interested in completing a training to become a death doula?
Volunteer for hospice is a great place to start also, because like I was saying, so many people are coming to this because somebody in their life died. And it's a very different ballgame to be with people that you're not emotionally connected to in their dying. And granted, I grow close with every client that I get to be with, but being able to volunteer for hospice allowed me to see what it's like when I don't know these folks. And it was eye-opening to see if I really wanted to do this work. It also gives you an insight into how the systems work so that if you do choose to do the work, you can understand how to navigate it a little bit better. read books, pick up books, talk to people about death and dying, attend some death cafes, host a few death cafes. That's an opportunity for folks to get together just to talk about the things that are on their hearts around death and dying with no agenda necessarily. Start to be in the work, talk about it and see how it's landing for folks and see how it's landing for you, because you might find that being the weirdo in the corner talking about death is not your jam. And if it is, welcome. We'll be here waiting for you.
So I had not heard the term death cafe. So is that kind of like you said, just kind of like an open forum for people to talk about like death and dying?
Yeah. So death cafe is actually a branded term. There's an organization called Death Cafe and they have some rules and guidelines for hosting a death cafe. But yeah, it's an open forum. There's nothing to sell, nothing to get, but rather an opportunity for people to talk through what they're experiencing and what they're curious about.
Got it. More from our conversation after the break. Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a National Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and Brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and Macy's is highlighting some really cool AAPI-owned brands right now, online and in-store. Some of my favorites are the jewelry from Hey Maeve and the skincare products from Kaja. For the entire month of May, join Macy's in supporting AAPI-owned fashion brands. You can show your support by donating online or by rounding up in store to benefit APIA scholars. APIA is the nation's leading nonprofit organization devoted to the academic, personal, and professional success of Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander students. Join me by rounding up your purchase to the nearest dollar at checkout to support API scholars, an educational nonprofit. Shop Asian American and Pacific Islander owned brands at Macy's.com or in store. Hey ladies, it's Dr. Joy here. May is High Blood Pressure Education Month. It's crucial for us, especially as Black women, to focus on our heart health. We pour our heart and soul into every aspect of our lives, but often our own health takes a back seat. That's where Release the Pressure comes in. It's all about us. Black women seeing self-care as an essential act of self-preservation. Whether it's for yourself, your family, or our community, your health is invaluable. Let's help to get our goal of 100,000 Black women putting their hearts first and learn more about their heart health. Here's how you can join in. Head over to iHeartRadio.com/RTP for a chance to receive a $1,000 gift card to take care of yourself and prioritize your heart health. Let's make our health a priority. Visit iHeartRadio.com/RTP today. Together, we can make a difference in our health and our lives. Join us, and let's take care of our hearts together. I'm wondering if there have been some like patterns that you have seen come up with like clients when you are working with specifically with the person who is towards the end of their life. Are there particular conversations or things that have been really difficult for them to deal with that you want to share with the audience?
Gosh, so many of them. Every part of who we are as humans shows up as we die. And so often the things that we struggle with while we're living are going to show up in our dying as well. And perhaps this is because of who I am and where I'm at in my life right now, but I'm being called to share the conversations around surrender and vulnerability that people really, really struggle with. At some point in our lives, this is if we live long enough to die as a result of disease rather than an accident or a sudden death of some sort. we will become disabled and we're going to need the support of another on some level. We live in community and we die in community as well. People don't just run off into the corner and die like some animals do, but rather it requires a whole team of people in this industrialized age, which means that folks need to learn how to surrender into receiving the support of another person. It's a lot of work. It's a big obstacle to overcome if you haven't been practicing it while you're living. And so that's one thing that comes up a lot. And I think something that Black women really also need to pay attention to, because I think for so long we've just put the weight of the world on our shoulders and on our backs and have found ways to cope and adapt to carrying it by ourselves, but we don't need to. And also at some point we're going to have to surrender and let somebody else support us too. So that's a big thing that comes up often.
It feels like that conversation is coming up in so many spaces, right? Like that in all of these conversations around Black women, like this idea of surrender and vulnerability and like being able to ask for help feels like a theme across so many different areas.
It's time. It's time. I am tired of being strong. Let me just keep it all the way real. But then also noticing how hard it is sometimes for me to just accept when somebody is showing up to help. I want to feel like I have it all together, but, you know, surrendering into the help of another doesn't mean I'm not strong. And also, what value is there in strong? I don't want to have to be. I'm okay with being tender and a delicate flower, which I actually am.
I love that. So for the clients that you work with who are not necessarily aware that they are at the end of their life, so they're doing more kind of preventative kinds of things, getting their affairs together, can you talk about some of the things that you talk with them about to kind of get them started on this path of dealing with the end of their life? Because I don't think, you know, like most of us are not in the grocery store talking about death, like you're saying. So how do you even enter into that conversation?
Well, most of these people have called me, and so they're ready for it in some capacity. But a lot of them are coming because of an event in their lives. I can think of a client not that long ago who had a pulmonary embolism that ended her in the hospital for over 3 weeks. And when she came out of the hospital, she was like, listen, I'm healthy again, but let's get this together. I also have a lot of clients that are raising children that have elderly parents or are watching their parents die and don't want that experience for themselves. They don't want to recreate it for their kids. And so they're like, let me get as much together as I can right now. And so often people are starting to think about it. And then they call and say, hey, this is just an idea. What do you think? And sometimes the conversation is, well, I don't think I'm dying right now, so why should I plan? And to that, I always say, well, how soon is too soon to start preparing for something you know one day is going to happen? I'm a last minute packer, for sure. I know I'm going on a trip about the flight, but I wait until the last minute before I go. I'm not going to be that way with my dying. I'm going to spend some time. I've been spending the rest of my life thinking about it and preparing myself in some capacity. And so we can warm up to the question and to the idea.
Got it. I'm wondering, what is the transition is the best word I can think of, but that may not be accurate. Like, you are somebody who's like kind of constantly working with people who are, their lives are ending. And so you become very close with the family, it sounds like. And so it's one of the only professions I can think of where you're constantly having to kind of deal with these relationships ending. What does the aftercare process look like for yourself when continuing to support yourself in doing this work?
It's not so glamorous. Immediately afterward, it looks like potato chips. It looks like kettle potato chips, mostly the salt and vinegar ones. Something about the fat and the crunch and the salt and like the bite in my jaw reminds me, it grounds me back in my body. I think it's an embodiment practice that I'm not conscious of, but it brings me right back into the body. That allows me to shore up those boundaries again and remember that this is mine and all that is not. All the rest I don't have to carry anymore. I often take baths also when I get back from seeing clients, sitting in the water and sitting there and watching as it all goes back down the drain for it to wash away what I'm carrying that isn't mine. As we were talking before about shadow work and being clear about what place I'm giving from, how I showed up in that space, giving myself and my clients a lot of grace. But longer term, I stay in touch with some of my clients, the family members after their death, and learning how to start shifting the dynamic of the relationship from one where I was available all the time and in a really deep emotional experience for them to one that allows them to be on their process with some support in the background. I also cry a lot. I grieve a lot. I grieve for my clients. I grieve with my clients. I grieve for myself because, as you were, I think, alluding to, I've grown in relationship with these people and then they die and my heart breaks every time. I think I've just gotten better at tending to it through my tears and my crunchy potato chips.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So you already shared that a lot of people kind of are brought to this work because there is a death experience or some experience in their life. And then they think, oh, I want to do this for work. I'm curious to know, what has this work taught you about living? And what do you feel like clients have kind of shared about life as they are nearing the end of their lives?
It's the most basic thing, but this work has just taught me again and again about the power of our time and our existence and the miracle it is to be living. Being present in a room where life has just left a body is profound. Not only does it humble me to the incredible mystery of life, but it also reminds me that I still have it for now. My body's still animated by that intangible thing that allows me to make eye contact and to eat cake and to dance in the rain and to sit and stare at a bird for a while, to speak my truth, to do what I want when I want to the extent that I can within the legal rules. And all that is an invitation into life. So being around dying repeatedly is an invitation into life. And I'm grateful, very grateful.
So you've shared this a little bit, but I definitely want to talk more. You're preparing to release your first book, Briefly Perfect Human. So can you tell us a little bit about the book and how you want readers to engage with it and what you want us to take away from it?
Oh my, yes, this book was really an opportunity for me to lay out my thoughts and ideas around how we die. It's a memoir, so it tracks my journey into death care from the practice of law and my life thus far, looking back and seeing how death had been interacting with my life all the way up in and through arriving at death care. And it also highlights a decent amount of my client's stories. So readers, I think, have an opportunity to look at their lives through the perspective of their own death, through mine as an example, and also learn a little bit about the practice and the work itself, and also hopefully chuckle a little bit. I think I'm hilarious. I was making myself laugh as I was writing the book, and I think that some of that carried through. My hope is, as I was saying before, I hope that this book serves as an invitation into the lives of the people that are reading it, as a reminder that this life is fleeting and precious, and that being here for all it entails can be a tremendous gift, not to discount the absolute privilege it is to be able to think about our mortality consistently and just even to take a time to read a book, but to be with the fact that one day I'll die and to use it in a way that serves my life. Yeah, that's a gift.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much. I think people will enjoy this read. So tell us where we can stay connected with you, Alua. What is your website and your social media channels, and where can we find a copy of the book?
Sure. You can find us anywhere on the internet at goingwithgrace.com or on Instagram, also goingwithgrace, but with some underscores. Otherwise, you'll end up at like a yellow Labrador dog someplace in Kentucky, and that's not me. You can find the book at any major retailer for books, but also please strongly consider supporting your independent bookstores. They need our support. Please, 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 please. You can find them at bookshop.org if you're not sure where an independent bookstore is near you. And yeah, I'm out in the world. So hopefully you'll see me someplace. I'll be in Seattle and LA and New York in the coming weeks, and workshops and trainings and webinars and the whole nine.
Perfect. We'll be sure to include all of that in our show notes. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Joy.
Absolutely. I'm so glad Alua was able to join us to share her expertise for this episode. To learn more about her and her work and to grab a copy of her memoir, Visit the show notes at therapyforblackgirls.com/session355. And don't forget to text two of your girls right now and tell them to check out the episode. If you're looking for a therapist in your area, visit our therapist directory at therapyforblackgirls.com/directory. And if you want to continue digging into this topic or just be in community with other sisters, come on over and join us in the Sister Circle. It's our cozy corner of the internet designed just for Black women. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. This episode was produced by Frida Lucas, Elise Ellis, and Zaria Taylor. Editing was done by Denison Bradford. Thank y'all so much for joining me again this week. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you all real soon. Take good care. Hey, ladies, it's Dr. Joy. As women, we put our hearts into everything. May is High Blood Pressure Education Month, and it's time to focus on our heart health. Release the Pressure wants to help Black women look at self-care as an act of self-preservation. During High Blood Pressure Education Month, let's help get to our goal of 100,000 Black women putting their hearts first and learn more about their heart health. Visit iHeartRadio.com/RTP for a chance to receive a $1,000 gift card to take care of yourself and prioritize your heart health. That's iHeartRadio.com/RTP. Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity. That it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a national Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results, made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less. Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at conairgirlbomb.com or a retailer near you.